media outlets operated from Iran, including PressTV.com. However, people can still log on using PressTV.ir. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
There seems to be no end in sight to the tensions between the United States and China. In the latest development, the US and some of its Western allies, including the UK, have publicly accused actors affiliated with the Chinese government of hacking Microsoft Exchange, an email platform used by corporations. That has escalated the already tense relations between Washington and Beijing, with the Chinese foreign ministry slamming it as, quote, fabricated allegation.
The US has mustered its allies to carry out unreasonable criticism against China on the issue of cybersecurity. This move is fabricated out of nothing, confuses right and wrong, and is an act of smearing and oppression that's wholly motivated by political purposes. China will never accept.
For years, the US and China have been at loggerheads over issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong and Taiwan, to the South China Sea. Last week, China was infuriated further after the US administration warned American companies and investors about the increasing risk of operating in Hong Kong. Washington claimed that those companies face multiple threats, including the Chinese government's ability to gain access to data foreign firms store there. The South China Sea is yet another bone of contention, with the US routinely sending its warships, citing its right to freedom of navigation. The US has no claim over the strategic waters, but it misses no chance to play with the sentiment of other countries having maritime stake over there. The UK, a major US ally, is also not far behind. London has now announced it would permanently deploy 2 warships to Asian waters. That despite China's constant warning to the US and its allies over their military activities in the region. It seems the US and its allies are concerned about China's growing influence around the globe. That was visible in a recent G7 meeting where the leaders of 7 wealthy nations agreed to counter China's economic and security influences. US President Joe Biden even urged European and Japanese leaders to offer hundreds of billions in loans to developing countries in a direct challenge to Belt and Road Initiative, which is China's global infrastructure development strategy. Beijing's relations with Washington reached to the lowest ebb during the administration of President Donald Trump, who waged a tariff war on it. China had hoped for an improvement in relations under Trump's successor Joe Biden, but he has shown no sign of discontinuing on his predecessor's hardline policies toward China. That has helped bring the Asian powerhouse closer to Russia, with both forming an invisible alliance. Biden will probably face a nightmare scenario given deepening ties and strategic cooperation between China and Russia, the countries Washington sees as a threat to its global hegemony.
The village of Vaux-sur-Chevremont on the outskirts of Liège has been devastated. 7 people lost their lives in last week's floods here. Hundreds have been forced to flee their homes.
When the water comes, I see it in my foot. I say, well, okay, we go home. But the water not in my foot come here, and I don't know what to say.
Meteorologists claim 2 months' rain fell here in just 2 days. It's being described as the worst natural disaster for eastern Belgium and western Germany in living memory. However, how natural is it? Climate change is being blamed. Also, there is criticism surrounding planning. Many towns and villages in Europe were constructed on floodplains. Some residents have been told it could be up to 8 months before their homes will be habitable again.
We lost our fridge. We don't even know where he is. He disappeared in the river. Everything is damaged. We have to do everything again.
There was also severe flooding in Netherlands, France and Luxembourg, but there's no doubt Germany and Belgium were hit hardest.
Many thousands of homes that were not destroyed are still without electricity, water and gas supplies. It might take weeks before those are restored. Aside from the tragic loss of life, the floods have caused billions of euro worth of damage.
Serious questions surround the effectiveness of the EU's flood warning system. Reviews will now be conducted to find out if all this human suffering could have been avoided.
When we get out of the house was the worst moment, because we have the feeling that we have lost everything and let it there and don't save anything.
The European Commission says it stands ready to provide whatever assistance is required. Throughout Tuesday, flags will be flown at half-mast in Belgium as the country observes a national day of mourning. Jerome Hughes in the village of Vaux-sur-Chèvremont, Belgium.
The morning of Eid al-Adha, Yemenis from all walks of life came together in front of the United Nations office in Yemen's capital Sana'a to call on the international community to redouble efforts to pressure Saudi Arabia into lifting the blockade imposed on the country.
We are here for the sixth Eid, demonstrating in front of the United Nations office in Sana'a. The international body has not fulfilled its duty towards the Yemeni people. More than 6 years have passed and we have been subjected to an absurd war that killed thousands of Yemenis. We demand the international community to lift the siege imposed on the Yemeni people and release the oil ships that have already obtained entry permits by the United Nations.
Protesters blasted the United Nations for remaining silent toward the Saudi suffocating siege on Yemen. They called on the international community to take real measures to stop the Saudi piracy against Yemeni oil ships.
We are still protesting in front of the United Nations office, especially on religious occasions, in order to expose to the world the complicity between the United Nations and the Saudi-led coalition, including piracy against Yemeni oil ships despite obtaining UN permits.
Since June 2020, Yemenis have been suffering from a harsh shortage of fuel due to the continued illegal seizure of Yemeni oil vessels by Saudi Arabia. The fuel crisis has heavily affected the health sector and left the war-torn country in a desperate struggle to survive.
After 6 years of war and blockade, Yemenis say the United Nations has not yet done anything to stop Saudi actions against their country. They accuse the international body of providing political cover for Riyadh's violations of international law. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
England's big relaxation of COVID restrictions, among them social distancing and face masks, is finally here. The government has called the changes an important step, but warned the public to be cautious.
This is a virus that is highly infectious, so we have to be careful, we have to remain vigilant. There is no perfect time to take this step. This is as good a time as any, as Chris Whitty has said.
However, many scientists disagree with the timing of this step into the unknown. More than 1,200 international experts have called it an unethical experiment and a threat to the world. The unlocking of England is happening even as the country's Prime Minister and Chancellor become the latest government officials to go into self-isolation over the weekend. Following contact with new Health Secretary Sajid Javid, who tested positive for the virus before them. The two were originally reported as exempt from quarantining, as they were joining a daily contact testing pilot, but did a quick U-turn shortly after.
But we can also see that they don't believe in their own narrative. It's very plain that they do not believe that this self-isolation would protect them or anybody else that they might have responsibility for. So the first reaction is to grab for something that gets them out of it.
Arrest the police! Arrest them!
The so-called Freedom Day met a protest outside the country's parliament, with the protesters calling for the Prime Minister to be arrested.
All this at a time when virus cases in the UK are in another rapid upswing, with one of the top scientific advisors to the government warning that the country is headed into the biggest COVID wave yet. Saeed Pariza, London.
How safe are our mobile phones? This is a question many activists and journalists have been pondering for some time now. And according to an investigation by 17 media organizations, it appears that many of their worst fears have been confirmed.
Their investigation found that human rights activists, journalists and lawyers across the world were targeted by authoritarian states using hacking software sold by Israeli surveillance company NSO Group. The spyware, referred to as Pegasus, acts as malware, infecting mobile phones, enabling operators to extract crucial information and secretly activate microphones.
So they're not just tracking criminal, but they're also tracking any professionals who are doing the job professionally, but the fear of being exposed by these journalists, and you become an enemy.
Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Hungary, India, Azerbaijan, Mexico, and Rwanda are the states that have been accused of purchasing the controversial software, with allegations that the hacking device was used on the phone of Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi before he was hacked to pieces inside a Saudi consulate in Istanbul back in 2018. Khashoggi's close friends were also believed to have their phones surveilled soon after his murder.
And in Khashoggi's case, this is clear. What he was doing is to expose the dirty things happening in Saudi Arabia, but obviously the kingdom and also the regime, the establishment, is not happy. And when an establishment is not happy, obviously they have all the resources to keep you quiet or to get rid of you.
If these allegations are proven to be true, it will indicate surveillance on a global level from Budapest to Riyadh that is not only a major world crime, but also an attack on the principle of holding authoritarian states to account. Ahmed Kibala, London.
Bilateral ties between Pakistan and a beleaguered government in Kabul have witnessed another low after Kabul recalled its ambassador and other senior diplomats from Islamabad, citing security concerns. It happened after the daughter of Afghan envoy to Islamabad was briefly kidnapped and released. The incident, according to police, happened during her back and forth movements on several cabs she herself hired for her travel between Islamabad and nearby city of Rawalpindi. The diplomatic row has preceded extraordinary territorial gains by Taliban, who now claim to have taken over 85% of Afghan territory following the exit of almost all US-led NATO troops from Afghanistan. Kabul has blamed Islamabad to have done little to contain the movements of Afghan Talibans from its nearly 2,700-kilometer-long porous border.
Networks and organizations supporting the Taliban are openly celebrating the destruction of the assets and capabilities of the Afghan people and state. Also, we call on Pakistan to use its influence and leverage for peace and cessation of hostilities.
Islamabad has repeatedly accused President Ashraf Ghani's government and India together to have provided sanctuaries in Afghanistan to anti-Pakistan terrorists who killed tens of thousands of people in this part of the world over the years.
No country has tried harder to get Taliban on the dialogue table than Pakistan. We have made every effort, short of taking military action against Taliban and Pakistan, we have made every effort to get them on the dialogue table and to have a peaceful settlement there. To blame Pakistan for what is going on in Afghanistan, I feel, is extremely unfair. Why would they listen to us when they are sensing victory?
Pakistani officials say that Taliban listen to them, but they do not control them. And over the years, Islamabad has lost significant influence on them. However, Kabul is not willing to accept this argument, given the ongoing military campaign by the Taliban, recapturing districts after districts with little resistance from the security forces in neighboring Afghanistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O, the most merciful.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, recently there have been demonstrations as the Cubans continue to deal with harsh American sanctions. And the president of this island nation is pointing the finger at Washington once again for provoking and encouraging unrest in Cuba. Well, stay with us as we put the spotlight on Cuba this edition.
The rally in Havana, with tens of thousands of Cubans taking part. They came together to voice support for the island's government and protest what they see as the U.S. meddling in their country's internal affairs. The rally was held just days after unprecedented unrest erupted in Cuba over an economic crisis aggravated by the coronavirus pandemic. Revolutionary leader Raul Castro and the Cuban president were among those attending the event.
We have come together to once again denounce the U.S. blockade, aggression, and terror. We could not put off this rally. The enemy has once again given everything to destroy the sacred unity and peace of citizens.
The Cuban president criticized the U.S. for spreading false information on social media. He also blasted Washington for defaming his government and inciting hatred and violence. He said the U.S. seeks to undermine peace and stability in Cuba. Criticism of U.S. policies vis-à-vis Cuba has not been limited to its shores. Russia has also accused the U.S. of plotting a color revolution in Cuba.
The logic is simple here. It has been tested on numerous occasions by Washington in various situations. But everything is the same, instigating color revolutions against undesirable regimes. At first, sanctions are introduced against them, and artificial problems are created or imposed from outside, which complicate the social and economic situation. On this basis, tensions are provoked, and anti-government sentiment is stirred up. When a critical mass is reached, the whole blame is laid on the national government. Labels are pinned on it, its activity is discredited, and thus the situation nears a collapse.
Iran, too, says the U.S. is the root cause of many of the problems in Cuba and should end its unilateral sanctions on the Caribbean nation. The bans were first imposed in 1960 in response to Havana's nationalization of U.S.-owned oil refineries following the Cuban Revolution. The sanctions were later extended. Even racial justice group Black Lives Matter publicly condemned the trade blockade, saying it's at the heart of Cuba's current crisis. In June, a total of 184 countries voted in favor of a UN resolution to demand an end to the US economic blockade on Cuba. Only the US and Israel voted against. That was the 29th consecutive year that the UN General Assembly called for the U.S. to end its Cuba embargo. Washington has ignored the international plea every time. U.S. President Joe Biden has called Cuba a failed state. The Cuban leaders deny that. But even if it's true, that claim serves more as an admission of guilt on the part of the U.S. than castigation of the island nation.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight. Out of Leesburg, Dennis Small, Latin American expert. And out of Washington, D.C., Shel Labash, writer and anti-imperialist activist. Thank you both for being with me. Let's start this off with Dennis. Your perspective, how do you assess the effect of over 60 years of sanctions by the U.S. on Cuba?
Well, I think these sanctions have been wrong for each and every one of those 60 years. But unfortunately, what we're facing today is a very different context than what has existed until now. And I think that the current sanctions against Cuba and the activities in the Caribbean more broadly are actually very, very dangerous. What I mean is the following. We're facing an international financial breakdown crisis underway in the transatlantic sector. This is something which my magazine, Executive Intelligence Review, has documented. documented in detail. And what you therefore have is among those big financial interests, an intent on a radical shift in the direction of world politics as a whole. I think that the blockade and what's happening with Cuba is even worse than it has been described in two regards. First, it is under conditions of a pandemic. That was mentioned, I think, very importantly so in your lead up to this discussion. Under current conditions, where we have a global pandemic which is out of control, to impose sanctions on countries that are facing this is tantamount to genocide. And I would like to strongly agree with what the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, has said, which is that all sanctions should be lifted under these conditions. I personally believe all sanctions should be lifted altogether, but certainly under these conditions. What's happening in various countries with the pandemic, it makes the issues of sanctions and regime change and color revolutions all the worse. Mm-hmm. The second feature of the current development, which I think is really serious, is that it occurs along with similar and related activities in places like Haiti and in South America, and in South Africa as well, not just South America, but South Africa. So I'll leave that for further elaboration.
Okay, well, Cheryl, what about what Dennis said? I mean, he talked about the UN Secretary General Guterres and basically saying, especially under these conditions with the pandemic, that sanctions should be removed. What does that mean exactly? If the UN Secretary General is saying that, if the majority of member states are for that, but then nothing happens, nothing changes, so tell me, what's going on here? What does it all mean?
Well, it all means, as my colleague said, that there is a global initiative on the part of the United States to restructure the world under its domination. Those days are past, but they are not sparing anyone in their and they're striving for hegemony. If you look at, of course, all of the sanctions should be lifted. It's unjust for unilateral economic war to be perpetrated on the people around the world. And Cuba's only one place. It's just the longest one and the one that's closest to the United States. But all of the sanctions should be lifted. I mean, has anybody looked at the fact that without a global response to the pandemic, the coronavirus is not going to go away? And the people who do not have vaccines are basically being thrown to death. And human beings are not expendable. That's a little bit the problem. You see this settler colonial imperialist attitude on the part of the United States saying, well, we're vaccinating people here. But the fact of the matter is, until the whole world is protected against the coronavirus, no one is going to be saved.
Let me cross back over to Dennis. I mean, it's part of a live program, right? Well, Dennis, your take on, you heard what Cheryl was saying. I mean, at the end of the day, what is the U.S. after in continually putting this type of pressure on Cuba? Because she talked about basically that every life is relevant and valuable, but it doesn't seem to be part of the equation in that settler colonialist mentality. How do you see it?
Well, I think you have to distinguish. There's different forces at play inside the United States, as there are in many countries around the world. And I think it's important to understand that there are distinctions and different points of view. Let me explain what I mean. There is an alternative that has been built over the last number of years internationally to the current bankrupt world financial system. And just parenthetically, when I say bankrupt, I mean bankrupt. You have $2 quadrillion in derivatives and financial speculation, which cannot be paid. And the attempt to hold up that bubble is what is behind the war drive. It is what is behind the austerity leading to the pandemic. It is what is behind all of these regime change operations, not just in a country like Cuba or Iran or Venezuela, but attempted regime change in Russia and China. That's what you're getting from the Wall Street and the City of London crowd. But the alternative that is existing at this point and that needs to be backed is what the Chinese have initiated with the Belt and Road Initiative, which many countries have joined in on at this point, in fact, the majority of the world's population, which has a different kind of approach to economics, which is not speculation and looting, but rather infrastructure and economic development. You can see the differences in the way the pandemic has been taken on. Now, we have an immediate situation around Afghanistan, which is, on the one hand, a very gravely dangerous situation, but also offers opportunities for a new kind of approach. Dangerous because with the departure of American troops, which is 20 years overdue after a 20-year war, and which many people in the United States, even included in the military, think that these perennial wars have simply got to stop. But you have a situation where, on the one hand, Afghanistan could easily tilt into becoming a center of world terrorism, of world drugs, of geopolitical destabilization and explosions. On the other hand, you have a confluence of forces coming together around the recent SCO meeting where the neighbors of Afghanistan, even though they have differences among them.
Okay. Well, now it seems to be Dennis's turn.
The forces that can actually help build.
Okay. Dennis, I'm sorry. I think it's your turn right now. We're having a little technical difficulty with you. Let me cross back over to Cheryl now. Cheryl, when we look at it, I mean, even when we're talking about the blockade or the sanctions on Cuba, I mean, isn't the main problem, it's not just the unilateral sanctions by the U.S., it's that the United States will punish or sanction any entity that actually want to have economic relationship with the country. Otherwise, if it was just the United States in itself, there would be so many other alternatives, but that it shuts down everyone and all other countries. Your take.
Yes. The extraterritorial nature of the blockade is really what is insidious. People in the United States, when they saw Barack Obama go to Cuba, it was like, everything is fine now. There's no blockade, relations are quote unquote normal. But the fact of the matter is, even then, the blockade, the economic sanctions, the economic warfare against Cuba continued. And what happens is the laws are so convoluted and complex that it becomes almost impossible to have trade. For example, to have a sale of pharmaceuticals, according to the U.S. law, you have to have a license. Okay, that's fine. To get that license, you have to agree to send a person to Cuba to verify that the end users are the end users. It's not a free and fair trade arrangement where people can, you know, the Cubans can buy from the United States and people and businesses can sell. It's all controlled by the U.S. government, and they make the conditions so onerous that it's impossible to do. And then third countries, like, for example, one that's used frequently is that the embassy, the Cuban embassy in Canada, leased Honda vehicles. Should be simple. They go to a Honda dealership in Canada, they lease the vehicle. It turned out that Honda was fined for doing that because the financial route goes through California where their leasing office, their big international leasing office is. So even the small thing of leasing a vehicle, of getting deliveries from DHL, now remittances are cut because Western Union can't process remittances to Cuban families. The web is just so hard to negotiate, and it affects the whole world. That's really what's happening, and that's why it needs to end completely. There's the people of the United States are standing up against the blockade. We have resolutions from elected officials and city labor councils all across this country, representing more than 30 million people in the United States. We have people in every state of the union who will stand up and say, hands off Cuba. We are growing the movement here to tell the U.S. government that it is time to end the blockade, and that we're not going to be distracted by this, you know, by all of these lies about what's happening in Cuba that are being fomented through a cyber war.
Dennis, you heard what Shell said, but I want to look at one aspect of that, because she talked about the growing numbers, the grassroots movement. But in general, is it about the numbers? Because if we're talking about majority, we know that 189 countries actually voted against continued sanctions. So she talked about 30 million people, for example, grassroots movement. Is it about the number of people that can pressure the U.S. government, or is it about the 1%? Which controls the U.S. government, that actually that's where they make the whatever decision they want to make?
I don't think it's either. I think the growth of 30 million people on policies that are appropriate is very good. But I want to emphasize that we're facing a different situation than we've been looking at for decades. There is a world financial breakdown crisis underway. That opens great dangers and great possibilities for a change in the big picture. If we don't change that big picture, the littler pictures, with all due respect to smaller countries, is not going to change. You have on the global strategic scene an alternative which is being put together around the Belt and Road Initiative, and that is an extraordinarily important counterweight, which is an area which people inside the United States should link up with. To bring sufficient pressure on this to change the situation, you're going to have to address the underlying blowout conditions in the world financial system and the economy, which is springing up these crises, creating these crises in various places. Listen, on this Cuba question, the president of Haiti was assassinated 4 or 5 days before the big demonstrations or the little demonstrations in Cuba, the unusual demonstrations. Cuba. Within 2 days of the president of Haiti's assassination, one of the three governments of Haiti that was claiming to be the government called for the United States to send in troops. Now, as of now, the Biden administration has said no, but it's not a very strong no. And I believe this is a very real possibility, given that there are people who are looking for a war with Russia around Ukraine and a war with China around Taiwan. So I think it's very important to look at the big picture. People should recall that Cuba is closer to Haiti than it is to the United States. We have the proverbial 90 miles or 103 miles between Cuba and Florida, but there's 60 miles from Cuba to Haiti, and the part of Cuba which is closest to Haiti is Guantanamo. Now, I'm not saying we're going to have another Bay of Pigs tomorrow, but I am saying there is an intention from a policy layer internationally to create crises everywhere to maintain their global system in place, and it's a financial system. Therefore, I think it's most useful to look at how to affect that global problem, change that, if we hope to have changes in policy such as this not only criminal, but really stupid policy, suicidal policy of sanctions against countries like Cuba or Venezuela or Iran and so forth. I mean, after all, we may think that we have a wall built around the rest of the world on the pandemic, but I would recommend that people read Edgar Allan Poe's story on the mask of the Red Death as to what happens when people think that they can simply wall themselves out of a problem which is international, and the pandemic does not respect borders or anything of the sort. It's good we've got vaccines here. The whole world should have them, but the vaccines will not stand up to new variants if we don't guarantee that the entire planet is safe from this problem. So that's what I mean by the global problems.
Shell, your take, because we're just about, we're running out of time. What needs to happen to change the status quo? I mean, we've been looking at this since 1959, since the victory of the Cuban Revolution in that country, the continual pressure by the U.S., the sanctions by the U.S., the military aggression also, and threats. What has to change?
Well, what has to change what is what we in the United States can do, because fundamentally, even though we laud the support from around the world and the voices from around the world, and it's very necessary, but fundamentally, it's our responsibility. It is a government that is acting in our name. And we have to really find a way, and that's why I emphasize that we've been doing this grassroots work. We have elected officials, we have elected bodies. I couldn't agree more that there are at least three, maybe more international crises that are transforming our world, not in a good way. One is the economic financial crisis, one is the pandemic, and the other is the environment. These crises are not going to be postponed. They're going to cause all sorts of problems and hardships inside our country, countries generally. Okay. So we have to step up the fight here at home.
And Dennis, 40 seconds. What needs to happen in your perspective?
The United States should join with China, Russia, and other countries in the Belt and Road Initiative. The fact that President Biden did sit down to talk with Putin is very positive, even though nothing particular came out of that, except the continuation of talks, recently a four-hour discussion. It is in the self-interest of the United States to work, for example, with China to build up the economic situation throughout the entire Caribbean region, Mexico. If you have illegal migration, you have to build these areas up economically and make them strong. And I think that this is something which the United States must be brought to understand is in our own self-interest.
Okay. And on that note, hate to interrupt you both, but I appreciate you being with us. We're out of time. Dennis Small, Latin American expert out of Leesburg, and Cheryl Labash, writer and anti-imperialist activist out of Washington, D.C. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Antidepressants do work for most people, and they remain important treatments for depression and anxiety, alongside behavioral and psychological interventions. Nonetheless, anyone thinking of starting an antidepressant should do so in the knowledge that they can sometimes be difficult to stop, and that slow, hyperbolic tapering may be required to minimize any withdrawal symptoms. We are prepared for an article written by David Taylor, Director of Pharmacy and Pathology at the South London and Maudsley NHS Foundation Trust. The piece is titled, COVID has led to record levels of antidepressant use, but withdrawal can be difficult. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. One of the impacts of the COVID lockdown since March of 2020 has been a widespread worsening of mental health, with anxiety and depression the most common symptoms reported. According to the NHS Business Services Authority, running parallel to this, the prescription of antidepressants in England has climbed to record levels. In the final 3 months of 2020, there was a reported 6% increase in prescription rates. According to the British government, 17% of the population were taking an antidepressant in 2017-2018, the last year for which figures are available. This rise probably reflects both the increase in diagnosis of depression and anxiety because of the pandemic and the restricted availability of talking therapies during lockdowns. While antidepressants play an important role in treating depression and anxiety, it's essential at this time of increasing usage rates to address how people will ultimately stop treatment. There are no reliable figures for the proportion of people suffering withdrawal reactions after stopping antidepressants, or for the fraction of people who have severe problems. Professor David Taylor writes, discontinuation problems vary according to dose, treatment duration, and the individual antidepressant. From my experience, both personal and vicarious, I would estimate that most people, a small majority, have only mild symptoms when stopping, and some, albeit very few, may have no symptoms at all. A good percentage of people, though, will have noticeable symptoms that are at best disturbing and unpleasant, and a small minority will have severe and even disabling symptoms that may linger on for many months or even longer. In my professional life, I've spoken to many patients considering antidepressants about their potential benefits and shortcomings. I also help develop guidelines on the optimal use and on how best to stop treatment with them. Perhaps more importantly, I have also taken antidepressants myself, and have gone through the process of stopping them. My personal experience broadly reflects what I hear from patients. Sometimes stopping is easy, and sometimes it's awful. Professor David Taylor says, in 2019, I co-authored a paper in The Lancet Psychiatry that recommended some patients may need to reduce their prescriptions over the course of many months, down to as little as 1/40th of their original dose, before giving them up entirely. Previously, standard advice was to stop taking antidepressants over the course of up to 4 weeks. Some official guidelines introduced in the past few years now reflect the findings of our paper and recommend what is known as hyperbolic tapering. If taken at low doses or for a few weeks or months, antidepressants seldom cause any significant problems when patients stop taking them. However, most current guidelines suggest continuing antidepressant treatment for 6 to 9 months after getting better to reduce the risk of a relapse into the original condition. Professor David Taylor says, this advice means more people may suffer some kind of withdrawal symptom when they finally try to reduce their dose. In medical textbooks and official guidelines, I'm informed that stopping antidepressants can lead to a discontinuation reaction. This reaction is usually described as mild and short-lived. I know from personal experience that if you don't do it right, stopping antidepressants can be a pretty horrible experience. Dizziness, nausea, anxiety, panic, mood changes, agitation, insomnia, nightmares, and electric shock sensations are all common symptoms. None are physically dangerous or life-threatening, but neither are they pleasant. This withdrawal syndrome is readily distinguishable from a return of the original depression or anxiety because dizziness, nausea, and electric shocks, known as zaps, are not symptoms of either condition. As well as a prolonged reduction schedule, the dose of antidepressant needs to be lowered in a way that gradually and evenly decreases its pharmacological effects. It may seem logical to reduce from, say, 20 milligrams a day down to 15 milligrams, and down to 10 milligrams, and then to 5 milligrams, and then stop altogether. However, for complex reasons related to something called the law of mass action, such a reduction schedule will produce even larger reductions in the effect of the antidepressant. Withdrawal symptoms may then get progressively worse with each step down, and some people will find it very difficult to stop if using this method. A dose reduction schedule that looks something like this: 20 milligrams a day, 10 milligrams, 7.5 milligrams, 5 milligrams, and then 2.5 milligrams, and even down to 1.25 milligrams, and then to 0.625 milligrams, as an example of hyperbolic tapering. It is thought to be the most effective way to reduce the severity of discontinuation symptoms, or even avoid them altogether. The difficulty, though, is that it may sometimes be practically difficult to measure the small doses needed at the end of the taper. Professor Taylor adds, patients have been doing their own hyperbolic tapering for many years, having discovered, often by trial and error, that it is the best method. I have read online accounts of people breaking open their antidepressant capsules and reducing the amount of medication inside by 1 grain each day. Needless to say, it is important to always talk to your prescriber before making any decisions about treatment, and the dosing schedules I give here are for illustrative purposes only. Antidepressants do work for most people, and they remain important treatments for depression and anxiety, alongside behavioral and psychological interventions. Nonetheless, anyone thinking of starting an antidepressant should do so in the knowledge that they can sometimes be difficult to stop, and that slow hyperbolic tapering may be required to minimize any withdrawal symptoms.
Good morning! Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.